It's the My Michelle Live podcast.
My Michelle Live, Sci Tech Talk, taking the God story to a geeky place. Here's Michelle.
Welcome to Sci Tech Talk. This is May the 4th. May the 4th be with you. Yes, I am. Welcome to Sci Tech Talk. Thank you for making My Michelle Live part of your day. We are taking on an interesting science project today that is turned into reality. Now, I want to tell you, this is kind of an interesting news story that is hot off the presses. There were six patients with dementia that took a little trip to Mexico. Well, that doesn't sound too unusual, but what they took their trip for, that is really fascinating. For an unproven gene therapy, six patients traveled last year during lockdown to be injected with a gene therapy that is not authorized for use in the United States, according to a CEO in the Seattle area where I broadcast from. Now, they have this startup here in Seattle, and they want to accelerate testing of an unproven anti-aging medicine. This is getting really into the area of science fiction. So hang with me for just a moment, then I'll introduce you to our expert guest. This biotech is called BioVera. And the CEO injected themselves with this experimental therapy in Colombia. And their advisory board actually has a Harvard geneticist, George Church, with which many people have heard about. To me, it sounds a bit like science fiction. It sounds a bit like something you may have seen in the movies. You know, I'm developing this therapy. It will keep me young forever. I will inject it in myself. Okay, so now I'm going to get serious with a grown-up here. We're going to let the grown-ups in the room. It really does sound like science fiction. But we're going to get into the science of it, and we're going to do it with a side benefit. We're going to give you reasons.
Live from Seattle gives you reasons to believe.
That's right. We're going to give you reasons to believe. Dr. Foz Rana is the Vice President of Research and Apologetics at Reasons to Believe. Authored many of my favorite books, has a way of taking very heady topics and boiling them down, making them really easy for you and I to understand and to bring a God story to it. So it's pretty fascinating. Creating life in the lab is one of them. The cells design, humans 2.0, all dealing with something very similar to this story. And by the way, many others that we're going to get into. Dr. Rana, welcome.
Michelle, thanks for having me. It's always fun to hang out with you.
Hey, I just found out something about our friend, Dr. Rana. He's a morning person. And I was pointing out, I think I can see a little pillow crease still in my in my face. I'm not a morning person. I don't know if there's science behind that, but that's science for another show. Is it in my genes? I don't know. But I do know this and many other stories. A 14-month-old, a little Danish baby was the first child in the world to get a full dose of a new gene therapy that is supposed to be this tremendous life-saving therapy. There are people who are putting their hopes, like the biotech company, in aging just being an option, no longer something that we're going to do. We can live forever. Oh, Fuzz, so much to talk about. Let's talk about, first of all, just to set the stage and help us to understand what is gene therapy and what is it not?
Yeah, well, I mean, the idea behind gene therapy is really, in many respects, pretty straightforward. And this idea, believe it or not, was first proposed in the early 1970s. And the idea is that we know that there are people that suffer from genetic disorders, you know, where part of their genome is defective as a result of mutations. And so the idea behind gene therapy is that if you could somehow either replace that defective gene with a healthy version of the gene or compensate for the defective gene by introducing a healthy version of the gene into the genome or at least into the cells, that you could essentially at least treat that genetic disorder, maybe even offer the patient a way to cure themselves from the genetic disorder. And so even though the idea is really pretty simple, you replace the bad part with a good part, you know, the implementation of this idea has literally taken us about 5 decades, but we are at the point now where this vision for really a revolution in medicine is actually now beginning to materialize. It's beginning to become a reality. And of course, it's very exciting, but it also raises feelings of disquiet in all of us, I think, because of the potential misuse of this kind of therapies.
All right. I want to talk a little bit about those misuses. What are some of the concerns? What are some of the fears? What are some of the reasons why we're kind of trepidatious?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one obvious fear would just simply be related to the safety of doing these kind of techniques, because when you are potentially modifying an individual's genome, and if that modification makes its way to germ cells, you could introduce genetic variants that are created in the laboratory into the human population. So that in and of itself has created some concern. But apart from that if you can, do gene therapy to replace a defective gene with a healthy version of that gene, why couldn't you go one step beyond that and create designer humans that have certain, desired properties or biological properties, characteristics, or even go one step further and enhance human beings beyond our natural biological limits? And so that is really, I think, the ultimate concern is, could we really modify human beings to such a degree that maybe what we end up creating in the process is something that we wouldn't recognize as being a human being by our standards today?
Now, you may not know this about Dr. Fazrana, as you're watching or you're listening, because he's very brilliant, but he also has a geeky side, and you and I share a love for like superhero type things, right? So I was just watching, and now this is a funny movie. It's called Thunder Force, right? Melissa McCarthy is in it. Really, really funny, maybe not for families, but it is a funny movie. And it really is about a brilliant young girl whose parents are killed by these kind of metahumans. And she decides she's going to develop something, some kind of gene therapy that will help make superheroes so that we no longer have to live in fear. And she chooses to inject herself. Wait, truth is as strange as fiction now. And that's really the premise of the movie. Now, how many films, how many movies, how many of our favorite geeky superhero indulgences and comic books have something very similar? Either the bad guy, something goes wrong, or whatever it may be. It's funny, but that's really what we could be looking at.
Yeah. And, this is what it really is kind of bizarre in some respects, is these ideas that we have become very familiar with when it comes to science fiction or even pop culture, superhero stories and things like that, are literally becoming, you know, reality before our very eyes. And so this idea of maybe one day, you know, injecting yourself with some kind of gene editing package to develop superhuman strength isn't actually out of reach. In fact, a team of Chinese scientists did a pilot study a few years ago where they took a particular breed of dog and they injected a gene editing package that disabled a gene called myostatin. And myostatin is a gene that normally controls muscle growth and development. And so the idea that some people have is that if for some reason this myostatin gene could become disabled, maybe you could compensate for people who have genetic disorders that lead to muscle wasting that are kind of, you know, degenerative disorders involving their musculature. But in these dogs who were, you know, a healthy breed, the net effect of, you know, disabling this particular gene was that these dogs became almost grotesque in terms of their musculature, where they were just these Arnold Schwarzenegger type of looking dogs. Well, you could easily see a pro athlete who wants to be stronger, who wants to be quicker, faster on the field, you know, injecting that kind of gene therapy, where now the modification becomes permanent. I mean, it's really a step away from, you know, the use of anabolic steroids for pro athletes. But, you know, this is demonstrated as being a viable way to enhance humans, or at least animals, but including humans, beyond our natural strength.
It's crazy. Truth, science fiction is becoming truth. I mean, and we've done shows where we've talked, Fuzz, about Star Trek, for example, and all of the technology that's in there that we're really looking at today, like you and I on a Zoom call, for example, broadcasting, right? Or this little thing that I'm holding in my hand, you know, my communicator, right? Beam me up. We don't have beam me ups yet, but I don't want people messing with, you know, that's just, I'm with Dr. McCoy on that. What I hear you saying, where this Chinese experiment with the dogs, it's Captain America, back to the superhero thing. It's just Captain America again. Hey, you know, little wimpy guy, big Captain America. This is amazing what we could do, and back to what maybe we shouldn't do or what some of the scary things are. One, in countries without serious ethics, and we'll get later to why we need ethics and where those ethics really have to come from, how do we know they're not already doing it? And how do we know what those side effects are? Has anyone watched those movies that I've been referring to? And there are other experiments and ways that we can manipulate the human genome. And we have a certain class of people that may have been edited. We have a certain class of people that haven't, the haves and the have-nots. We see that also with technology and wanting to augment humanity with implants, inserts, you know, it's the bionic man and woman all over again from those TV shows way back in the 1970s.
Yeah, you know, this is the thing that probably concerns me the most about this emerging technology, is particularly thanks to the advances with CRISPR gene editing. It's such a powerful technique. It's so versatile and it's easy to use, and it's relatively accessible in terms of its cost. And so it actually has spawned something called the biology DIY movement, the biology do-it-yourself movement, where there's an attitude in this movement that this is such powerful, transformative technology that it shouldn't be only in the hands of the biomedical and the scientific elites, but rather it should be democratized, where everybody should have access to this technology and we should be able to apply it to ourselves in any way that we see fit. And one of the leading advocates of this biology DIY movement is a person by the name of Josiah Zehner. And it's almost, you know, taking on the attitude of the next generation of civil rights, you know, where denying people access to the technology and the freedom to modify themselves in any way they want, you know, is a fundamental human right that is being denied by, you know, keeping the technology in the hands of, again, the scientific and the biomedical elite. Well, to me, there's a good reason to do that, because if you're trying to regulate the technology, it's easier to regulate it at that level where you can have the appropriate oversight. But once, you know, this technology is in people's garages or yeah. in some kind of, you know, startup, you know, company that, you know, has a storefront, you know, in a shopping mall, how do you control, how do you regulate this? Or, you know, there could be governments who see this as an economic boon, where they literally allow for this technology legally within their borders as a way to promote a type of genetic tourism.
Hence, six people just went down to Mexico to get injected so that they can live forever. There's the possibilities are starting to become real. And if you'll forgive me, you know, you and I have been friends long enough to know that this is going to happen. I am going to take us off the main path for a moment and ask an absolute ridiculous question. So if let's just say hypothetically, you were going to get injected with something, what would your superhero strength be?
I don't
intellect, because you already have it, darn it.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, that super soldier injection looks pretty tempting.
I am Dr. Fosrana. All right, I like it. There you go. Just wanted to know, you can be strong and smart. Yeah, that's a dangerous combination. I like it. I think you'd be a great superhero. There are some really good things that can come out of this. And that baby out of Denmark, her name's Alyssa, and she had, I think, maybe less than a half a dozen genetic disorders, most of them just horrible and most of them deadly, almost guaranteeing that her life would end by age 5.
Yeah.
So to be able to have even if it's experimental, gives the parents some hope. A conversation that is difficult to have is, should experimental drugs and therapies be available? And, you know, I think there's a point where life is on the line, that if that there is just certain death, that as a parent or as a person, if it were my body, saying, you know what, okay, at this point I'll try anything to save life. But this is a very big news story, and this shows and highlights some of the other good things besides making you a superhero that potentially gene therapy can accomplish.
Yeah, well, you know, and this is the complexity of you know, of these emerging technologies, is it's on one hand so easy to see the misuse of them and then, you know, react in a guttural way that maybe we shouldn't do this at all. But then on the other hand, we see really enormous benefits. You know, that story in the USA Today, I think it was written by Karen Weintraub, just this incredibly well-written story, you know, that takes you on this journey with the parents of a little Alyssa, where you see the despair they have and then the sense of hope that maybe gene therapy could somehow rescue their daughter. And then even now the struggle they have with, are we actually helping her? Or are we prolonging her pain and her suffering? So a well-done article, but it also shows the power of this, you know, and the effectiveness of this experimental therapy to provide a treatment, maybe even a cure for, you know, things like Tay-Sachs disease and Sandhoff's disease, which is an immediate death sentence, you know, once you're diagnosed with that. And to think that you could arrest, you know, the neurodegeneration, maybe even reverse it, is remarkable. And if we had the ability to detect Sandhoff's disease or Tay-Sachs disease very early on in the child's development, you could intervene even before the symptoms of the disease kick in and lead to the neurodegeneration. So this is really, really exciting stuff that could just revolutionize medicine on one hand, you know, and really fills people with legitimate hope. And this is science and technology at its best. But again, if you can do that kind of genetic manipulation, what's to keep people from going to the next step and saying, well, I want to do that manipulation, you know, to become, you know, intelligent beyond normal human capabilities.
And then what's the side effects? Like you said, we don't know if we're prolonging her suffering. We may not know what some of the side effects are. There are great potential therapies to help Alzheimer's patients. These therapies are being granted a fast track from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. This could be fabulous. So if anyone has sat in front of grandma while she doesn't recognize you and see that very slow, painful death that Alzheimer's brings, this is elation. Yet, what do we know about the side effects? I mean, that's when experimental becomes, well, experimental.
Yeah, and the article did this great job about talking about the role of animal testing and the fact that they thought they had an effective therapy. And when they applied it to monkeys, it actually did the opposite of what they intended. And they realized that they didn't have the dosage right, you know. And so, you know, there are things that we just don't know. Oops. We just don't know, you know, what happens when you start manipulating humans or animals at a genetic level, you know, and what we think may provide momentary benefits may in the long run, you know, introduce problems that we never would have anticipated.
All right.
So this is the challenge of developing this. And this is what you hope, you know, through clinical studies and animal studies, that we figure out how to use the therapy well and minimize the, you know, and understand what the, you know, the side effects are. But to think that there's not going to be side effects is really, I think, really naive. And for people that want to start injecting themselves with these things, you know, you may end up having the opposite effect of what you hope.
Yeah, and then there's the should scientists be allowed to grow human embryos, you know, in a dish beyond 14 days. That's been a big news story and something that they've been talking about, you know, to grow grotesque, humanesque babies, for crying out loud, you know, well, all in the name of science to save lives. Our ethics may not be there. And we're going to talk about ethics in just a moment, but something that is a big, to me, the bigger story beyond ethics is how we really don't know what we're doing. Now, it's kind of, it's as though I'm a computer programmer working from home, and I have all of my code up programming something very important project. And, you know, since COVID, I'm working from home. A 3-year-old comes in and right? That you could mess things up. A teenager, smart teenager, who's maybe even gifted in that, could go in and kind of mess things up, right? Our genetic makeup is on beyond that level of brilliance and programming, which to me leads to the ethical discussion. Because with that level of intricacy, it is really illogical to deny some kind of programmer, and the implications of a programmer leads to other scientific realities that point to a creator.
Yeah.
In my humble opinion.
The thing is that the human, you know, genome is far more complex than anybody even imagined when the genome was first sequenced. And we're beginning to discover that there are, you know, components in the genome that we thought were completely useless that are absolutely critical.
It's like tonsils. We were taking out tonsils, you know, back in the day. You don't need tonsils. It's a product of evolution that, you know, we just don't need anymore. And then come to find out in our lifetime, from the time they were taking them out and all the lucky kids got to stay home from school and eat ice cream. And my mom said, no, I think there's a use for, I think God gave us tonsils for a reason. Mom, no, I want to stay home from school and eat ice cream. Come to find out, mom was right. And in the same way, you know, some of these things that we think are useless, we're finding as that we are a little bit more backwards in our science and our knowledge than we really realize. Is that not the case?
It is the case. And you know, we want to be very careful about, again, you know, declaring something to lack function or not appreciating the complexity and the intricacy of biological systems. You know, and it's one thing to, you know, replace a single gene that we know is defective with a healthy version, or to introduce a gene in addition to what's present in the genome to make, you know, healthy copies of a protein. That's one thing, because you're making, you know, basically monotonic changes. But when you start talking about doing, you know, gene editing that could impact, you know, more complex traits, you're really, you know, like intelligence or strength or height, you know, you really are playing with a system that we don't understand at all. You know, there's a network of gene interactions that are controlling most of our biological traits. And, you know, each gene is involved in a number of different networks. So you start messing around even with a single gene, and you can have, you know, effects beyond what you thought. But to me, when I look at the complexity of the genome, it really looks like it's something increasingly that you would attribute to the handiwork of a creator, not, you know, the product of evolutionary processes. And I think even thinking about the genome from an evolutionary perspective has actually delayed critical understanding of the genome that has biomedical implications.
That's a powerful statement. Can we just delve into that briefly? Why is that? You're saying that to look at the genome as a product of evolution has potentially stifled our progress in understanding and in developing some of these gene therapies. What is it about evolution that doesn't sit right with genes, so to speak?
Yeah, well, you know, the idea from an evolutionary perspective is our genome has just been cobbled together, you know, through evolutionary processes.
And just happenstance.
Yeah, and that there are, just like tonsils are vestigial and the product of evolution, the argument goes a lot of the features in our genome are vestigial of an evolutionary history. They may have been functional elements that were rendered non-functional because of evolutionary events. And so the net effect is that people argued that probably 90, 95% of the human genome consisted of junk DNA sequences that really had no functional role at all. And yet when we began to do what are called genome-wide association studies, trying to identify regions of the genome that actually seem to be responsible for certain genetic disorders, certain diseases, what we were discovering is the regions that seem to be responsible were actually what we thought to be junk DNA. And we are now at the point where we think most of the human genome is actually functional in some capacity at some time during the course of the organism's growth and development. But the where evolution stifles things is that if you think a sequence is just junk because it's the leftover vestige of evolution, then, you know, why even study it? Why even pay attention to it? Whereas a design, you know, perspective would say, we may not understand it, but we are convinced that it's functional, therefore we need to study it. And so there are regions of the genome we just left uninvestigated because we didn't think they were important, and they turn out to be important. And so that has delayed understanding, that, you know, has delayed you know, the biomedical applications of that understanding. So it's, you know, like the example of the tonsils, right? Hey, they're not useful. Let's just cut them out, right? And your mom had that insight that really came from a different view of humanity than most in the scientific community would have, which is if we're the product of a creator, then there's a reason why those tonsils are there. And we now discover that they actually are playing really important roles, and that, you know, tonsillectomies are not necessarily the way to go.
Right? And that gives a cause to ponder some of the ethics and some of the other issues. If you come with this assumption, we know it all and this is the way things are, and we see a lot of that in our society today. This is the way things are. If you think differently, you're bad, you're evil, it's horrible. When we have that assumption, we aren't open-minded enough to think, well, maybe there, even we'll just take God out of the equation for a moment. Maybe there might be a use for it. Maybe we don't know everything that there is to know. But then you move to a deeper level and you say there is a designer. There is intelligent design. You and I are of the mindset that if we look deeply into the evidence of what that design is throughout all of the disciplines of science, you can see signs of him, and he seems to resemble the God of the Bible in uncanny and unbelievable ways.
Please keep your arms and hands inside the podcast at all times. Buckle up and enjoy the ride.
Get lost in his forest. Citrus pine beard oil.
From Real Bearded Men at MyMichelleLive.com.
Listen live at MyMichelleLive.
When you realize that all things, all of those things within the human genome, Dr. Rana, are useful, even the things that you don't think are, you know, it brings a congruent idea to the universe. The things that happen in my life that I think are useless and not useful, the people in my life that I consider useless, everything has a purpose. Wait, all things work together for good to them that love the Lord and are called according to his purpose. Bible verse. That is a consistency, which is another evidence to me of a designer, the consistency of the universe. So all of these things lead to that ethical question where we talk about, you know, what can we do? What should we do? And who decides that? Because if there is not, I'm sorry, I'm opining here, but if there is not a God, then where do ethics come from? And where does that marker get to be moved?
Yeah, that to me is, you know, I think what is really concerning is that because we live in an increasingly secular world, people want to turn to secular systems of ethics to try to make decisions about what technologies we should pursue. And if we do pursue it, you know, how should we use
that
technology
work?
Specifically?
I mean, can that work?
I don't think so. Because ultimately these ethical systems are based on some type of utilitarianism where you're looking for what is the greatest good for the greatest number of people, you know, and that leads to scenarios where there are people that are marginalized, but that it's okay to marginalize those people. You know, and mm-hmm. so that to me is the ultimate concern I have with secular ethics. Whereas, you know, the ethics that flow out of the Christian faith says that every human being has infinite worth and value, and that God is revealed to us through the record of nature, and that God has provided for us through the record of nature. And so these are strong motivations to do science, to understand the world, to try to take that understanding and use it for the benefit of everyone, but it also puts in place this safeguard that keeps us from exploiting people or dehumanizing people, you know, in the process of trying to develop technologies, you know, where many of the scientists and the technologists doing this work, at the end of the day, do have noble objectives. They want to, you know, mitigate pain and suffering in the world. They want to help people flourish and realize their potential.
And they will. In many of these cases, we're going to develop it. We're going to be able to help these children with genetic disorders. We may be able to help with Alzheimer's and a lot of other painful diseases by reaching into the DNA and replacing what's damaged, much like going in and getting a heart transplant. You know, we may be able to transplant, and that's great that we can do that. That's glorious. That to me as well, Fuzz, speaks to our being created in the image of God, wanting to value life and having the uniqueness among animals to be able to do such deep and amazing things. But as we move forward, you're right, dangerous territory without some kind of ultimate guideline.
Well, you know, to me, the irony that I see that flows out of, again, a secular type of bioethics is, you know, this intuitive knowledge that human life has value, so we want to do what we can to help those people that are suffering. But yet, on the other hand, if you develop a utilitarian perspective, then you say, well, it's okay to create human embryos to develop stem cells that could be then used to treat patients that are suffering from debilitating diseases and injuries. And so you're willing to sacrifice one human life for the sake of another human life, and you do it under the justification of this concept called personhood. But you know, recently there was work done where people were creating these monkey-human chimeric, you know, embryos, these chimera embryos. And the motivation for this was, well, people are dying because they are waiting on organs for transplants, and this is the pathway to creating maybe animals that have humanized cells that could be used, you know, for organ transplant therapies. But the problem is that to create those chimeras that are going to be a source of organs, you have to create human embryos in vitro as a source of those human cells that you're implanting in the monkey embryo. And the ethicists were more concerned about the moral status of the human monkey chimera embryo than they were about the human embryos that were created in vitro to provide the cells to create those chimeras. And that to me is the problem with secular bioethics, is it's inconsistent. There's an incoherence to it where, you know, you're right, Michelle, that image of God in us recognizes intuitively the value of human life, but apart from it being anchored, you know, robustly within a Christian worldview, you wind up with these muddled, you know, decisions, you know, in this muddled thinking about, you know, what we should or shouldn't do.
Wow, that sounds like the world we live in at large, right? I mean, take it out of the cool possibilities of healing people with Alzheimer's, or even almost a year ago, a news story came out of possible dinosaur DNA being found, right? And so Jurassic Park all over again, you know, all of these wonderful sci-fi movies are becoming almost reality. But when we look at the world without some kind of ultimate good, that inconsistency, we see that even in our struggles with COVID, the inconsistency, the only, you know, we're only going to pay attention to this kind of science. It's unethical and it's awful to talk about anything else. We are in some ways seem so more backwards than we really think that we are. And I wanted to wind up our time today with just a single question about the importance of the God story, because you mentioned a Christian biblical worldview. That goes beyond just a God story, having a God ethic, to a very specific faith. Why is that important to this story?
Well, you know, to me, and there's a lot of different ways I think you could go with this, but, you know, to me, what I am most concerned about is that increasingly people are turning to science and technology as the source of their salvation. Mm-hmm. And so we're very subtly seeing increasingly people making statements that I see all over social media, like
science is God. That is a big sign along I-5 in Seattle. Science is God. Yeah, but who made science anyway?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. And, or I believe in science. And so, you know, instead of turning ultimately to the person of Christ for salvation and recognizing that we are a creature who's been made by a maker, but that maker wants us to be in a relationship, and that really our true objective for eternal life is to know the creator and to be able to live with that creator for all eternity in his presence, is really, you know, where the ultimate source of salvation comes from. But what we see happening is increasingly people are turning to science and technology for their salvation. So instead of science and technology being a gift to us from God that is a tool to help us, you know, realize the kingdom of God here on earth, it is becoming essentially the God that people choose to worship and where people put their trust. And that to me is I think the concern that I have, because there are always these unintended consequences. We don't know what we think we know, and what is going to happen is science and technology will ultimately disappoint us, you know, and you know, God, the God of the Bible through the person of Christ, will never disappoint.
The same yesterday, today, and forever. We can see his fingerprints in the designs of even our genes, things that we didn't even know when the theory of evolution was just eking itself out of the goo. We didn't know about some of these phenomenal things that we can only see in microscopes, and then the things that make up those things. And that there's so much that we do not know in the intricacy. But in all of those things, whether it's on a microbiological scale or it's on the scale of the universe, God's fingerprints are everywhere. And when you see the congruent way that it flows, that's so exciting. Yeah. Through the conversation we have today, through what goes on in life, that consistency gives us just a security and a strength and even a hope. That's why I love science, because this geeky science talk has really led to bolstering my faith. I want to thank you again. It's always such a pleasure to have you with us, Fuzz. And my love to all of the guys there and gals at Reasons to Believe. You can go to reasons.org. There are articles upon articles on juicy things like this. And then you can click a link and go on a rabbit trail. You could spend all day there. It's wonderful. But when you're there, also stop by their shop, okay? Because their books, like many of Fuzz's books, off the charts. You'll love it. You bolster your faith through science. What could be cooler? Fuzz, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. It's been a pleasure.
Like us, share us, go to mymichellelive.com for more information.
More SciTech Talk at mymichellelive.com.
And that is a wrap.